With the broken economy by far the issue that mattered most to voters on Election Day, President-elect Barack Obama will formally unveil his team of economic experts to help fix things today. We've known since Friday that Obama plans to name New York Fed Chief Timothy Geithner as his new Treasury Secretary. One of Obama's top advisors, David Axelrod, tells Fox News Sunday, by temperament and experience, he is the right man to lead the department. Former Treasury Chief Lawrence Summers will be tapped to be the head of the National Economic Council, and Obama aides are calling on lawmakers to pass legislation by January 20th, Inauguration Day, that meets Obama's two-year goal of saving or creating 2.5 million jobs. We will talk with our guest this hour about how President-elect Barack Obama is responding to the economic crisis, and we will talk about what we might learn from the past about dealing with this crisis today. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will welcome in a columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post who has a new book out. Robert Samuelson is the author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence, and he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us. I do want to talk about your book, but first, your reaction to the new economic team that President-elect Barack Obama is going to be formally announcing today?
Well, there are no surprises here, and I think in many ways people ought to be reassured by that. The people who Obama is said to have selected are all experienced. Timothy Geithner is now the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York during the Clinton administration. He was a high-level Treasury official. Larry Summers, who will be the head of the National Economic Council in the White House itself, was Treasury Secretary, and before that was, I can't remember whether he's either Deputy or Under Secretary of the Treasury. Austin Goolsbee, who is said to be the Chairman Designate of the Council of Economic Advisors, was not in previous administrations, but is a well-regarded economist from the University of Chicago. So this is a middle-of-the-road seasoned team. I think the one worry you might cite is the possibility, the ambiguity of who actually is the administration's senior economic advisor, whether it's Summers or Geithner. Now, the fact that they have worked together before and they are friends may make this a moot issue, but I think that's an issue going forward. And also whether or not the Council of Economic Advisors has usually been the president's in-house economic advisory team. The fact that Summers, who is a world-class economist, is heading up the National Economic Council raises doubts about how important this council will be, because previously the person who has held that job has not been a top-level economist and has really just coordinated the views of other agencies and advisors.
The news of Timothy Geithner being appointed new Treasury Secretary on Friday was met at least by Wall Street with some good news in terms of stocks trading up on Friday. Was that a reaction from Wall Street that they approve?
Well, it's hard for me ever to know what the stock market what message the stock market is sending by doing whatever it does, and why it goes up and why it goes down. I think that probably people on Wall Street were looking for any bit of good news, but this was widely rumored. And so the fact that there was sort of an official leak that seemed to make it official, why that triggered such a rally, if it triggered such a rally, is a mystery to me, to be honest with you. Let me give you some figures here that just show you how erratic the stock market has been over the last couple of months. Mm-hmm. Since the middle of September, the market has moved either up or down 4% or more on 25 days. There have been 50 trading days in that period. So we're talking about every other day. In the previous 25 years, the market had moved up or down 4% 25 times once a year. So the market, to say the market has become volatile is like saying the Grand Canyon is a ditch. We are in completely new territory here. I mean, investors basically don't know what's going on, and they have these sort of wild emotional swings one way or the other.
Yeah. And then I don't know what's going on this morning because I've been stuck in the studio, but I do know that the news of the morning is that the government has to bail out this Citigroup.
Well, Citigroup is one of the nation's largest commercial mm-hmm. banks, and it has over 300,000 employees around the world. And they have issues similar to the issues that led to the failure of Bear Stearns, led to the failure of Lehman Brothers, led to the government takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the problem is that they had a lot of these very dubious and weak mortgages and mortgage-backed securities on their books. And people don't know what they're worth. And as a result of that, there's a crisis of confidence. And when there's a crisis of confidence, you find people who have lent to Citicorp or whatever the institution that's targeted, either lent to them or trading with them, become reluctant to do so. And so what the government has done here is basically they've done two things. They put more money into Citicorp. We just look at the Wall Street Journal. I think it's another $20 billion. They put $25 billion in a few weeks ago, about a month ago, and now they've added another $20 billion. And more importantly, they have basically said that the government will insure the losses on a large chunk of Citicorp's securities. So there's government backing now for Citicorp, and the fact that this has occurred would have been inconceivable a year ago. Hopefully, this will restore some confidence in the financial system as opposed to simply being another step in an ongoing crisis.
Yeah. Well, let's talk some now about how we got into this mess, based in part of the great inflation of the 60s and 70s. You claim that that period of time and the fix to that inflation led to where we are today?
Yes. I think the roots of this really go back a long way. I argue in my book, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, that the rise of double-digit inflation in the 60s and 70s and the fall of double-digit inflation in the 80s and 90s and in the beginning part of this century, taken together, really constitute the most important economic event of the last half century. And let me just concentrate on the fall of inflation because that's really, I think, what's most immediately relevant. If you go back to 1979 and 1980, inflation was in double digits. It was 13% in 1979. And more importantly, people did not know whether that was the end of it. The government had proved incapable of controlling inflation, and it gradually crept up from about 1% in 1960 to 6% at the end of the 1960s, 12% in the mid-70s, and 13%, and rising rapidly in the late 70s and early 80s. Paul Volcker, who was then chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, put the country through a brutal recession. Unemployment reached 10.8% in late 1982. Ronald Reagan, who had just been elected president, backed him. And together, their alliance, I call it a compact of conviction, because they both believed that high inflation was going to be was and would be devastating to American society. Basically, that brutal recession squeezed out inflationary psychology. So by 1983, inflation was down to 4%, and by the end of the 90s and early in this century, it was down to 1%, which is where it had begun in 1960. Now, how does this connect to where we are today?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened? As inflation came down, interest rates came down, people moved their money from money market funds and treasury securities into the stock market. The stock market experienced a huge boom. As mortgage rates came down, housing prices went up because people could afford more with a given mortgage because the interest rates were lower. And let me just remind you, in 1980 and 81, mortgage mortgage rates were almost 15%. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened, and for a long time that was very healthy. We basically had a sustained prosperity over two decades with two very modest recessions. And here's the connection, though, with what's happening today. The fact that we had such a sustained prosperity for so long, and the fact that people got used to, and by people I mean not just ordinary investors, but money market managers, portfolio managers, bankers, investment bankers, traders, the fact that they got used to the markets just going up repeatedly induced careless and complacent behavior. The extension of mortgages that essentially were unjustified. People thought risk had disappeared from the financial system, at least diminished, and they began doing stupid things. And we are now really suffering the consequences of a lot of investments that were made based on a very rosy outlook for the future that extended as far as the eye could see. So it's the decline of interest rates, which was connected to the decline of inflation, that basically propelled the stock market and the housing markets up and gave people these euphoric, created this kind of euphoric psychology.
Yeah. So we don't want to go back, though, to double-digit inflation, do we?
I don't think we want to go back to double-digit inflation. And the problem that the Federal Reserve and the government faces today is that they want to stimulate the economy. They don't want it to go into a free fall. But on the other hand, they don't want to stimulate it so much that, as you say, we go back to higher levels of inflation, which are very damaging to the economy, but also create an enormous amount of anxiety. People just don't know whether they're going to be able to keep up or not.
We will talk more about what we should do to get out of this financial mess and what we can learn from the past about the future. Our guest is Robert Samuelson. He is the author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your questions for him, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. It's All Things Political with Kathleen and her guest after 9. They will discuss the latest on the Senate race in Minnesota, President-elect Obama's cabinet picks, and the lame duck session in Congress, among other things. That's coming up in All Things Political after 9 with Kathleen Dunn. We are talking with Robert Samuelson, a columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post, who has been writing about business and the economy for more than 30 years. He is the author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. And we have one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Go right to the phones and take our first caller, Jim in Green Bay. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Say, I just got through reading Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first inaugural address, March 4th, 1933. And I'm telling you, if you read what this man put down on paper, it's almost like what's happening today. And one of the things he mentions in there is, as far as what brought us to the situation we're in, was greed and self-promotion by the politicians. And I think it's true right now as it was back in the 30s.
Is there more parallels there, Robert Samuelson?
Well, I think that people are making this comparison with the 1930s and the Great Depression. But we need to remember a couple of things. One, the Great Depression was a real social catastrophe, and what we have today is a problem. And it's a tragedy for some individuals, but the scale is... There's no comparing the scale of what's happened in the 30s. In the 1930s, unemployment reached a peak of 25%. It averaged 18% for the entire decade. So today, the unemployment rate is 6.5%. We are a long, long way from the 1930s. There are some, I think, eerie parallels. One of them is that in the early 1930s, people really did not understand what was going on, and this included top government officials and economists. They really didn't understand. There's a little bit of that today. This recession has been triggered by events in the financial market that were really not anticipated and are not well understood by most economists and most sophisticated observers, of which I am not one, but the people who are running banks really caught by surprise. So that's an eerie parallel. However, before we get too gloomy about this, we ought to remember that economists and historians looking back on the 1930s concluded that government actually contributed to the creation of the Great Depression. That after 1929, and there's no doubt there was a lot of greed and a lot of speculative behavior in the stock market, we had what would have been or might have been an ordinary recession. But the government was not very active in trying to cushion it. And it allowed, between 1929 and 1933, about 40% of the banks to fail. People lost their deposits, the sources of credit dried up. And in the view of most economists, that failure of government policy really contributed to the creation of the Great Depression. Hopefully, we are not going to repeat those mistakes this time around. And government has acted pretty quickly, even if sometimes clumsily, to make sure that to try to provide a kind of safety net for the economy.
Yeah, I don't know if it's funny or not, but I heard a commentator talking about the Great Depression is when you saw people in tattered clothing begging with a tin cup for a dime, and now it's corporate CEOs flying to Washington in their corporate jet asking for $25 billion.
Well, it's an interesting metaphor, and I would say as long as it's the corporate executives are coming to Washington, and we don't have people begging for it would now not be a dime but a dollar,
right?
You know, we'll be better off. What happened in the third? Franklin wrote nobody really solved the Great Depression. What ended the Great Depression was World War II, and that's a little bit sobering. I mean, they spent a decade trying different things, and they mitigated the worst conditions in the Great Depression. They never really got the economy going on all cylinders until the war came along, and it was just a huge demand for everything for wartime spending.
Yeah, let's take a listen to Barack Obama in his in a weekend address talking about the need for an economic stimulus package.
I have already directed my economic team to come up with an economic recovery plan that will mean 2.5 million more jobs by January of 2011. A plan big enough to meet the challenges we face that I intend to sign soon after taking office. We'll be working out the details in the weeks ahead, but it will be a two-year nationwide effort to jumpstart job creation in America and lay the foundation for a strong and growing economy.
And his team put a price tag on that yesterday, probably $500 billion in stimulus for this program. Does that sound good, Robert Samuelson?
Well, I think it's justified. We'll have to see the details of it to see whether you can approve of the concept, but I think the concept of trying to create demand in a period when there's very weak demand and people are worried about a kind of vicious spiral downward, I think most economists support that. We shouldn't, however, lose sight of the fact that this should be a temporary stimulant to the economy, and that what you need ultimately is the economy to generate jobs and demand on its own. So I think you can justify this as a way of getting a way of offsetting the downdraft that we're getting from the housing slump, that we're getting from the slowdown in consumer spending, but ultimately, and allowing consumers and households to pay down debts, which they find too oppressive and too high now. But hopefully after a year or two, the economy will begin growing on its own, and you don't need to resort to this. Because over the long run, we need to actually curb federal spending, and it seems to me, get the budget back into some sort of semblance of balance. And spending another $500 billion every year is not the way to do that. So Obama faces a very difficult task, and that is what he should do in the short run, which is, I think, stimulate the economy and through more spending and perhaps even some more tax cuts, is not what he needs to do in the long run, which is to sort of find a way of getting spending and taxes back into balance at a level that allows the economy to grow.
Yeah. The other news over the weekend was that he might allow the Bush tax cuts just to expire when they were supposed to expire in 2011 or 2010, rather than roll them back sooner.
Well, I have been saying, although I haven't written it, I've been saying for weeks that nobody's going to raise taxes next year. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not going to raise taxes on people who have over 250 or 500 or a million, in my view, and they're not going to raise capital gains taxes, which is the tax on profits from stocks. When the economy's this weak, the symbolism of raising taxes is just lousy, and it will undermine confidence, and so it's just not going to, in my view, it's just not going to happen. I don't know whether he'll propose it, mm-hmm. propose raising the tax and then just let it die, or whether he will do what the leaks suggest over the weekend, which is just let these tax cut, this particular tax cut, expire at the end of 2010. But I don't think the Congress is going to raise taxes next year on anybody.
Back to the phones. Rich and Nina is with us. Hi, Rich, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. We've got our first snowfall. Is it beautiful?
If you like snow, Rich.
I just wanted to, Joy, I called in a couple of weeks ago, and I left I was talking to somebody, and I don't think anybody had the answer, but I got an email from a financial planner, and what it said was, it was quite interesting. It said, what if we took the bailout money, and I believe, and I don't have a calculator big enough to run these numbers, but it said, if you gave every person in the United States 18 years or older $200,000, a family would get, $400,000, so on and so forth, that we could do this and get out of this a lot quicker and stimulate the economy a lot faster from the trickle-up theory. And I'm just wondering what your comments may be on that.
Do you have comments on that, Robert Simmons?
Well, I have to take out to do the arithmetic, but that sounds like an awful lot of money to me. And if you just flood the economy with money, I think ultimately, I think if you gave everybody $200,000, I agree, a lot of people would go out and spend a chunk of that pretty quickly. On the other hand, I think you would also create a lot of inflation ultimately, and I think the sheer magnitude of that and would probably undermine confidence. It does not sound, and I think at the end of the day, you'd have to say, what do we have to show for this? People went out and bought more flat screen TVs. Do we really need more? I don't know. I'm hoping that what Obama proposes and what he suggested he's going to propose would give us some infrastructure spending, things that will have permanent value for the country. And I think there will be some relief for state and local governments so they don't have to fire as many people and cut as many programs as they would otherwise have to cut. I would much prefer to go that route than simply, I mean, the amounts of money that the caller mentions just strike me as massive.
Yeah, it does. Well, what if it's not $200,000 per person? What about the basic concept of stimulus
Obama
at the bottom?
Well, Obama has suggested
the top, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Middle-class tax cuts, and mm-hmm. Republicans, for their part, are always in favor of tax cuts. They seem to, any tax cut for anybody any time seems to be a good idea. So if you have a modest tax cut in this plan, and Obama during the campaign suggested for most middle-class working families either $500 for a single worker or $1,000 for a couple, I mean, that's not out of line. But again, we do have this long-term problem of balancing the budget, of finding ways of either cutting spending to the level of taxes that we're comfortable with, or raising taxes to the level of spending we're comfortable with. And I'm not suggesting we ought to do this tomorrow or even next year, but we need to get on a glide path that does this sometime.
You know, President Bush attended his eighth and final summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in Peru. At that summit, the global leaders there were saying that this global economic crisis will be over in 18 months. Does that sound good?
Well, if that turns out to be true, it certainly sounds good, and it's not implausible. We do have recessions, and recessions since World War II have ended. And as I say, the most serious recession we had was at the beginning of the 1980s, and unemployment got up to almost 11%. And that was a reaction to the high inflation of the 1970s. And it was deliberate recession, basically induced by the Federal Reserve in an effort to get down inflation by creating unemployment, creating gluts of steel, cars, shopping malls, office space, and just beating down prices. It was an awful event, but it was necessary because inflation was getting out of control. But recessions do end, and they end because there are usually some self-correcting mechanisms in the economy. People pay down their debts, and after they pay down their debts, they feel more comfortable spending more. Excess inventories get sold. Prices do come down, and things become more affordable for people. And government policies tend to promote expansion and recovery. So it's not illogical or to think that this crisis will be over in a year or 18 months. But there are differences with this recession than most of its predecessors. I would say all of its predecessors since World War II. And the main difference is that the financial system in this recession has really been heavily damaged. And so its capacity to increase lending, which is really important for recovery, is under a cloud. So, I mean, we'll have to see what's going to happen, but it's not implausible to think, in 18 months, the worst of the crisis will be well behind us.
Yeah, I'd like to know if you agree in concept with what President Bush said in Peru and what you think is going to happen. He said that the recovery and continued economic prosperity is going to depend on free markets, free trade, and free people.
Well, he had, that's an expression of his political philosophy, and I think most Americans certainly believe in the last, free people. Mm-hmm. I think that over the long run, reasonably free markets in this country have generated prosperity. They've generated new ideas, new companies, new enterprises, new technologies. I think we're going to see a swing back towards more government regulation. But I agree with President Bush that if this goes too far, the implication is if this goes too far, it may stifle the kind of innovation and risk-taking and investment that we need in the long term to stimulate economic growth. And I think that's one of the challenges that Obama has. He, I think, wants to restore confidence to the markets by assuring people that government is not going to let things get out of hand. On the other hand, he doesn't want to over-regulate the system so much that he just discourages people from taking risks. And, taking risk means running the risk that you're going to fail. And that's part of the system. We can't outlaw failure. And as for free trade, I would say, if countries were to go protectionist in any large way, that would be very negative for the world economy because a lot of investment takes place under the assumption that the companies making the investments will have access to markets around the world. And if they don't, they may reduce or even eliminate their investments because they just don't know where they'll be able to sell their product.
More calls. Sandy in Algoma. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. You know what? I wanted to go back to what Rich was talking about earlier, and that is the $400,000 per family. I had also heard the same thing, and I heard this gentleman or your speaker saying that the answer was not to flood the economy with money. But you know what? $700 billion from what I understand, $700 billion has already been either spent or planning to be spent to bail out these big businesses, And meanwhile, what would be the difference if it starts at the bottom versus starting at the top? If $700 billion is going to be out there anyways, wouldn't it be better to have all these families be able to pay for their mortgages, pay their car loans, pay their credit cards? None of the big businesses would be defunct then. They would all be getting their money. So, you know what? I don't really understand it, besides the fact that in this country, in a capitalistic society, the rich will always be richer or be able to get richer easily, and the poor will always be poor. So it doesn't seem like that will ever change, and it doesn't seem like the government is ever wanting that to change, because most of the people that run the government are rich.
Is that what's going on, Robert Samuelson?
Well, I've done my arithmetic here, and maybe I've got this wrong, so I don't want you to. By my arithmetic, the 400,000 would be over $40 trillion. That's a lot of money. If you put $40 trillion out there, there's no telling what would happen, but prices would certainly go up a lot. And I think you would. And we now have an economy that produces $14 trillion every year. That's our GDP. So when you talk about $40 trillion, you're talking about more than 3 years of production. The entire stock market, which is admittedly down a lot from what it was a year ago, is worth about $10 or $11 trillion. So when you say giving $400,000 to everybody in the country or every family in the country, you're talking buckets and buckets and buckets of money. That's number one. Number two, the $700 billion, and it is an astonishing amount of money. I don't want to minimize it. And if you had suggested to me, or I think you'd suggested to anybody who spends their time watching the economy, 18 months ago that the government would be in the rescue business to the tune of $700 billion, I think we would have looked at you as if you were crazy. So it's a lot of money, $700 billion. But the expectation, I should point out, is that most or all of this money is going to be repaid to the government, and even at a profit. So it's not a question of giving the money permanently to financial institutions. Now, some of these expectations may be disappointed, but the point is that it's not a $700 billion giveaway. Part of the money is going to be repaid, whether it's $600 billion or $715 billion, I don't know, and no one knows. But the idea is that this is a kind of temporary support for these financial institutions so they don't stop doing what the economy needs them to do, which is lend. And in the Great Depression, one of the problems that led to the Great Depression is, as I mentioned before, so many of the banks failed. And so their ability to make loans obviously disappeared, and the deposits that were left in the bank were frozen, so the people whose deposits they were couldn't spend them and couldn't use them to pay their bills. And so that was a powerful force for deflation and a contracting economy. So as attractive, I mean, I'd love for my family to get $400,000. Even $100,000 would be great. $50,000 would be good, too. But, you know, I don't think we can look for those kind of solutions as being realistic.
Our guest is Robert Samuelson. He is the author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. The book examines what he calls one of the most important economic events and what it can teach us about the future of America's economy. We welcome your questions for him about his book, about current economic trends, what's going on with the financial crisis. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. It's All Things Political after 9. We are talking with Robert Samuelson. He is a columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post and the author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. Before we go back to the phones, what is the future of American affluence, Robert Samuelson?
Well, my view is that even after we get out of this recession, which I hope President Bush is right, we're out of it next year or 18 months, even after we get out of the recession, I think we face a period of slower economic growth and more conflict among different groups for larger pieces of the economic pie, of a very slowly growing economic pie. And I think there are a number of, I think the prospect for younger workers and younger households is that the modest increases in income that they get are going to be siphoned off to higher taxes, higher energy costs, and higher health care costs. And so their discretionary income will not go up much, if at all. And I think that, the sense of sort of running in place will induce a fair amount of social and political conflict as groups, you know, try to get their part of the pie. So we're still going to be a very wealthy society as we are now, but we are not going to, I think, experience the kind of growth in living standards and incomes that we've been used to in the past.
And when you say younger workers, you're talking, the current generation.
About people now. I mean, I've got three kids between the ages of 18 and 23. I'm talking about them. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people in their 30s and early 40s. I'm a baby boomer or almost a baby boomer, and as we retire, the costs of paying for the current Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits are going to be huge for the federal government, and they're either going to force large tax increases or dramatic cutbacks in other programs, most of which I think would be undesirable, or budget deficits that over the long run will be unsustainable and would ultimately, again, either create tax increases or cutbacks in other spending. Yeah. So that's one force that's sort of operating on my kids and other and younger households. Another is just the prospect of higher energy costs. Now, oil prices have been fluctuating so dramatically, you don't know whether they're going to be higher or lower, but my view is that over the long run, they're likely to settle in at higher rates, both because of the scarcity of oil on world markets and because of anti-global warming policies that will raise energy prices. And finally, we just haven't learned yet how to control health costs. Now, maybe President Obama will come forth with a plan that can do that. But so far, successive administrations of both parties have been unable to find a socially acceptable way of controlling health spending.
Yeah. Can you give us a little better idea of what you mean by these different groups fighting over
You know, I think it part of it's going to be young and old. Mm-hmm. I mean, the federal government, 40% of the federal budget already goes to older people, to retirees, either through Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. And that's going to go up as the baby boomers retire. So I think one of the conflicts is going to be between young and old. Some of it will be between economic classes, rich and poor, middle class versus rich, and maybe middle class versus poor. I think you will see conflicts between regions and industries as people, as industries try to get special tax breaks or subsidies for themselves. You know, any kind of conflict that involves money, it's just not class warfare, which is the kind of cliche, but any kind of conflict where somebody can get more and force somebody else to get less, I think you're going to see those kind of conflicts increasingly in the system. And that's what politics is about, sort of allocating society's wealth, and that's what the market is about. How much is going to be done through the market, how much will be done through government. But I think one of the ironies of what's going on today in Washington is that the incoming administration, and this would have been true if McCain had won too, is denouncing and has denounced special interests. But the more that government regulates the economy, the more lobbying you will have, because all the people who are regulated want to influence how the government regulates them. And that's what democracy is about. It's about how the government affects you. So the more powerful the government becomes, the more lobbying and special interest representation you'll have in Washington. I don't regard that as illegitimate, but there is a certain irony to it, and I think, again, there will be competition over who should be taxed, who should get benefits from the government, and how you go about regulating the economy for the benefit of some and at the expense of others.
Back to the phones. Lisa in Waukesha. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. Just kind of along the lines of what your guest was saying, I think if you look at the United States, we have a philosophical approach to our economy. I think we are one of the lowest taxed industrialized nations in the world. I don't think a lot of Americans realize how inexpensive it is to live here. The corollary to that, in my opinion, is that when times are great, everybody does well and everybody's happy. When times aren't great, we don't have the underpinning to support the lower people, lower income people, and they become marginalized, and we all start to suffer. So it's kind of a philosophical approach to how the U.S. runs its economy versus a country like Canada or Europe with more social services. People pay 40 or 50% tax, and they actually have a much happier standard of living or a higher satisfaction rate. So it's interesting to me how much we complain about the government, but how little we actually pay. And it's kind of a cost-benefit thing.
Mm-hmm. A reaction to that, Robert?
Well, we certainly pay. I mean, the caller is certainly correct in that the United States has a lower overall tax burden than many other advanced societies, Europe and Canada. I mean, when you put the federal taxes together with state and local taxes, we pay slightly over 30%. And as she said, many other countries are in the range of 40 to 50%. It's not true, however, that other countries seem to be happier than Americans. Americans are more optimistic than many other societies, and by some when pollsters ask people whether or not they're happy, Americans do pretty well on the satisfaction, personal satisfaction scale. There's a different ethos in this country than there is in most countries, and there's more emphasis on opportunity and individual responsibility. Now, you know, she is right that this is a political choice we have. It is not, although we are different from other societies, it is not true, however, that, you know, we don't pay any attention to the poor. I mean, compared to before the Great Depression, the social safety net in this country is massive. And it's not dissimilar from what you have in other countries. It's just not quite as generous as what other countries have. But it's quite similar to what other countries have. So the question is, one of the trade-offs you get, though, for having a sort of a more comprehensive and more generous social safety net is that these other countries in general have less vibrant economies than we do. And if you look at Europe, you also see that the birth rates are quite low. Now, it's not clear. Scholars who have studied this don't really have a complete explanation for it, but I think one explanation for it is that the high level of taxes makes it harder for people to raise kids, and so they don't have kids. Now, that may be good in the short run if you want to maximize income to the couple, but for the society in the long run, it's ultimately suicide. And if you look at the birth rates in Italy or Germany, they're quite low, and they are not reproducing themselves, and you have to ask yourself, what is going to happen to those societies in 40 or 50 years? I don't know.
Let's go to another caller. Thank you, Lisa. Ryan in Whitewater. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'd like to know your thoughts on my big fear for the economy, that given all the debt that we've been recently incurring, that the U.S. government is going to eventually lose its AAA rating status and the spiral effects that will raise.
Well, I think it is a danger, but I don't think it's a danger tomorrow morning or even next week or next month. We have our debt is very large in dollars, but it's not so large compared to our economy. The economy is now roughly $14 trillion, and the debt held by the public is in the order of $6 to $7 trillion. When you look at it and do the arithmetic, the debt is about 40% of our economy. At the end of World War II, it was over 100%. I'm not saying we should go back to 100%, but even with these additions to the debt we're going to have in the next couple of years, we're well within our capability of servicing the debt that we already have. The problem is that we have this huge gap and it's going to be growing, between what we're willing to pay in taxes and what we want the government to spend. And unless we bring that under control, the caller is right. At some point, the annual deficits will create such a large public debt that our ratings will go down, and at some point, and more importantly, the cost of paying the interest on that will become a larger and larger part of the budget, and that will squeeze out other government services as well. So I think this is a problem. It's not a problem that has to be addressed tomorrow morning, but as I said earlier, it's something that the new president needs to reconcile, the need to spend more immediately to prop up the economy, and the need to reconcile our government spending and reasonable taxes in the long run.
Mark in Maguanago emails, how much of the current situation is due to the bad mortgages themselves versus what the financial institutions did with them? That is, how much worse did they make things through leverage, bundling of the mortgages, and credit default swaps? And we only have a couple of minutes.
Well, I think the implication of his question is right. I think that bad mortgages by themselves could have been quarantined, compartmentalized off from the rest of the financial system, we would not be going through the kind of crisis we're going through today. The losses, while large, were not crippling. What is the problem is that the way these things have been bundled and the way they've been pyramided upon by various other securities has created a kind of domino effect that has to, you know, just gone through the entire financial system. So I think the caller is right, and the problem lies in a lot of this so-called sophisticated financial engineering, which turned out to be not very sophisticated.
Yeah, and in our final 30 seconds here, the bailout money already given out, the $700 billion, is that going to be it? Are we going to be able to bail out the financial institutions and turn this economy around?
Well, all the $700 billion has not gone out the door. I think something less than half of it has gone out the door, although I'd have to check. And that really is the open question as to whether or not and how much more we might need to underpin the financial system to begin to restore confidence. And that, I think that's one of the basic issues that the new president is facing.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Robert Samuelson is the author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. He is a columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post as well. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and Rob Ferret for on-air production and direction. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.